Welcome to episode 5 of Techish, featuring yours truly, Abadesi.
And Michael Behane.
Michael Behane.
Yeah, we're back.
We're back. I can't believe it, man. Five episodes deep. Getting more and more praise all the time.
Yeah. No, we really appreciate all of the love that people are showing us. It's nuts.
The shout outs, the shares,
the tweets.
People on Twitter using the hashtag Techish. It's amazing. David McQueen on that vibe. I respect
Shout out
that.
David McQueen.
Like,
he tweeted us. We appreciate that.
Probably the most famous person to touch base with us so far. To be fair, we launched on Product Hunt on Friday, which is amazing. Got lots of love. I'm excited. I mean, there's so much to cover this week. I didn't even know where to start. From Cambridge Analytica to Rihanna on Snapchat.
Theranos? I said it wrong. But yeah, those guys.
Back in the mix. Always there.
Oh, Lord. Should we start with, you want to start winners and losers or you got...
Let's jump straight into winners and losers. Sure, let's start on something positive because I feel like people who've been following Twitter, following tech news, have already had a storm of negative stuff. So sometimes get to do something...
Switch it up
a bit.
So who's the winner? Who's the positive person or thing that's happened?
So I think it's really cool that Jay-Z has invested in this startup called Promise, which is basically trying to change the way that we reform prisoners and... challenge the whole prison system. If anyone who's listening watched Ava DuVernay's amazing documentary 13th,
yeah, that was amazing.
Then we know that when it comes to judicial systems and penal
States.
Systems in the States, it's pretty messed up.
Yeah, it's terrible. I think Jay-Z actually wrote an op-ed in the New York Times a few years ago, basically saying how the criminal justice system in the States has to be reformed. There's too many black and brown men just like tied up in non-violent crime, spending like languishing away in prisons for things they haven't.
Yeah, I think there's
shouldn't be there for.
There's like overwhelming evidence now to show that things like racism are supported by state institutions,
Completely,
right? Because we've
yeah.
seen it in the police, we've seen it with the prison systems, we've seen it with bail and hearings and stuff like that. A study came out earlier, like this week as well. I actually didn't read the article. I only read the headline. But it basically said that like if you are like a rich white man in America and you're a rich black man in America, even if you start out the same, 30, 40, 50 years deep, the white guy is still doing better because of you know all these crazy
structural
systems we're talking
about,
structural oppression. Black people are just disproportionately disadvantaged, black men specifically. So this is really exciting. Like, one, Jay-Z getting in the game, diversifying
Jigger.
His portfolio. Big pimping VC game.
But I really love it, though, when I see, you know, influential and successful, you know, African-Americans or black people in general leveraging their wealth into A, tech, and B, tech for good.
Like, for sure.
It's definitely my favorite story of the week because the rest of this shit is just really depressing.
It gets crazy. I also thought like one thing to say before we move on to another story is when we think of where like capitalism in general, let's just think of like big corporate companies, where they're heading in terms of ethics and values and missions.
Mm.
We're seeing a lot of movement towards social impact. So, okay, like how are we actually benefiting the individuals and the communities we're affecting? We spoke a bit about this last time.
Have you heard of B Corporations?
Go for it.
So B corporations are what are called benefit corporations. They're based in the States. I think it's benefit, but it's essentially it's a corporation that is not just set up specifically for a return on investment of a shareholder. So one of the arguments against capitalism is that once you reach the stage of becoming a corporation, your number one objective is return on investment for your shareholders, essentially. So a B corporation is a type of corporation where it's not just that. You can also emphasize doing good or your employees or your environment, whatever it may be. And so Etsy is one, actually. There's a few other prominent ones. And I was happy to see it existing because at the same time, I would classify myself as a capitalist in the sense that I run a business. So in that sense, I am one. But one
We're
of the arguments...
capitalist.
We all are. But then, I mean...
You can't escape capitalism.
You can't escape it. But in the sense that if you're a worker, you're not necessarily a capitalist. You ply your trade and you give your labor for money, essentially. But you're participating in it.
Capitalism...
Yeah.
We can't. You live outside of like.
Yeah.
No, but, I don't even know what a kibbutz. Then you're in capitalism.
Yeah. No, but if you're somebody that invests your money, then you're that's what traditionally is called a capitalist, as opposed to somebody who gives their labor out for services.
So you mean like a capitalist has to have capital?
Yeah. Essentially, yeah. So a B Corp, and one of the arguments against capitalism has always been that, as much as someone like me who'd love to reform it for good, the bottom line is it's your legal obligation as a shareholder or as a manager of a company to return maximum profits to your shareholders. That's actually your legal duty. If you're ever found to be against that, then you could actually be prosecuted. So a B corporation circumvents that, and I think it's a great step. So what you're talking about, actually, how did I get into the subject again?
You tell me.
That's a very good point.
I was talking about social impact. Social impact.
There we go. Yeah. So it's a vehicle for social impact is what I'm saying.
Okay, that's amazing. Like, one of the things that I get frustrated about, it's kind of like similar to diversity and inclusion, how people like separate making money and building successful businesses from doing things which are just inherently good for people. Mm. And while I think it's incredible that there is a structure like a B Corporation, I feel that like companies might think, oh, if I choose to go down that route in terms of how I incorporate, I may be less profitable than my competitors because I'm competing with companies that aren't optimizing for good or equality, whatever. I want to optimize for profitability. And I think what's interesting about the conversation happening within social impact and impact investing in just like the traditional corporate space or whatever, is that we're starting to realize that you are as profitable if you do these things, if not more profitable.
I think you can be, but I think there are instances where that's not the case. I think sometimes we have to be honest. Like, for example, if I'm running a factory, it might be more profitable for me to pollute the river. Why worry about, you know, expensive things where I can make sure I'm not effing up the environment?
Because you're creating a negative externality and somewhere down the line, you will be affected by it.
People are very short-sighted.
But that's not the question you asked.
No.
You're arguing with an economist, so you better be careful.
I want to step up to the challenge. Okay, I want to step up to the challenge.
Go for it.
So oil companies, for example, are very profitable. And now it's actually come out.
Not as profitable as they used to be because oil prices are falling. But
okay, yeah. But historically, they're one of the most profitable companies that could ever possibly exist, not hypothetically,
tech historically. Tech companies probably make more profits than them.
You think so?
Well, now.
Yeah, that's true.
Apple.
Okay, anyway, well, they're doing fine. Let's say that's all I'm saying. And it's actually come out that they've hidden the fact that they knew that global warming would be the result of what they were doing, essentially, the work that they were doing. And they chose not to do anything about it because it would impact their profits. So there are instances where doing good does curtail profits. My argument is that that should happen because you shouldn't maximize profits at every turn. Like, we should have to acknowledge the fact that in a lot of instances, you're right, profitability and good go hand in hand. But there are a small section of cases where that's not the case. And we have to be honest and say, you're not always going to make 100% whatever return you want to make. Sometimes 80% is fine.
I think you're like oversimplifying it, if I'm honest. And I think it's like been very easy for people historically to like oversimplify it and go, what makes us the most amount of profit in this period now? But in reality, like, that is just a number, and you're focusing only on like a certain number of levers which impact that number. You don't know that like other levers which you're not pushing or other channels that you're not putting resources to couldn't equally create that profitability for you, right? Like, that's just like one approach. So we have one way of looking at things. We've had one group of people dominating the way that these decisions are made. So I just think that's like totally oversimplifying it. And like, the more we always oversimplify this argument, the more likely we are to remain in a world where the environment is just, you know, shat on by everyone, excuse my French, and we don't go anywhere. So I think like it's incumbent upon us to challenge that narrative every time the opportunity presents itself, because okay, even to say like, okay, I'm just thinking for the short term, and in the short term, it's more profitable for me to pollute or create negative externalities or whatever, that's like a really limited way of thinking. That in itself may not even be true. Those people are taking massive salaries. There's so many things that they could save costs on or divert costs from one thing to the other and be more sustainable without actually affecting their profits, but they choose not to.
I think to a certain extent we're not disagreeing. I agree with everything you just said there. I just think that there are people in those positions who have historically thought short term and have done that. They have maximized profits at the expense of doing good, is what I'm saying. And I'm saying, you're right. You know,
in fact, we can bring it back to the prisons. Let's talk about the 13th, just very briefly, because if you think of the prison system, it is a for-profit system in the US, isn't it? Right.
Part of it, yeah.
What has happened is lots of prisons are overpopulated. People aren't eating well. They don't have food. They may not have access to books to read.
There's more prisons in general because the incentive is there.
Yes. And then even worse, we find out that prisoners are actually performing labor, right? This is like the new slavery. So they are manufacturing products and conducting any other services
for like 1p an hour or something crazy.
For profit companies.
It's crazy.
So let's go to your point, right? Okay, well, they have a legal responsibility to their shareholders to maximize the profit. At the expense of like basic humanity and ethics?
But my argument would be that those companies shouldn't exist because profit is not an almighty good. They shouldn't be profitable companies. They shouldn't exist. That's the point I'm making. When we prioritize good, there are certain instances where profitability has to slightly go down. There are other instances where they can go hand in hand, but there are certain instances where this company shouldn't exist or this industry shouldn't exist.
What shouldn't exist?
So the private prisons, for example.
But they do exist. So how can you argue that?
Exist is what I'm saying.
But they do.
I know that, but that's the point I'm making. I'm talking about what should be the change in the future. These companies are allowed to exist by government. It's not just a natural creation of the market. The governments have said, okay, to cut back on costs, we should have private prisons because the private sector can do it better, that's a dogma that a lot of these governments have, which I don't agree with. So I'm making the point that they shouldn't exist. And in this instance, it's for the better of society.
Mm.
These profitable companies, in air quotes, shouldn't exist. That's the point I'm making, that sometimes profit and good doesn't always go hand in hand in small instances.
So Promise,
mm-hmm.
Are they going to be a profitable company?
I hope so. I hope they are. But I'm not making the point that good and profits don't ever go together. I'm not making that point. I'm making that sometimes there's a contradiction and sometimes that the company shouldn't exist or should be less profitable. But in this instance, I'm not saying that we should never have companies that do good and that are profitable. I run a company that tries to be profitable and tries to do good at the same time. So like I know that those two things can work in symbiosis. But we went on a massive tangent. But the thing is, I do want to keep an eye on this company. I'm really happy that they exist. I'm glad that Jay-Z's invested.
Let's hope they do good and become one of the most profitable companies
in the world.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, shout out to them. Like, it's necessary.
Okay, we've got to jump into the losers here. Let's start with Cambridge Analytica. Because what the hell's going on?
What the hell is going on?
So did anyone watch the Channel 4 Panorama? It's available on YouTube. Channel 4 have done a massive expose. This is like years and years of undercover investigation and research. So kudos to the journalists. I think lots of journalists from The Observer and The Guardian were involved as well. So if you're thinking of donating, now's the time.
Yeah, for real.
So Cambridge Analytica, political consultancy, quotation marks. A data scientist that worked for the company, quit, then went through some legal battle with them, has basically come out and whistleblown and talked about the fact that there was a huge Facebook data breach that enabled Cambridge Analytica to manipulate the results of elections in the US, Argentina, Russia, the list goes on and on, although Cambridge Analytica deny any involvement. So if you haven't had a chance to read it, maybe I'll just explain exactly like how they were able to do this data breach. Mm. So there was some scientist commissioned by Cambridge Analytica who created a personality test.
Mm-hmm.
And you could pay to download this app, which is like made by Facebook, whatever, to do this test. Now, you gave consent for the results of the personality test to be used by research.
Mm.
But what you didn't see was that within the source code was the ability to access any other underlying data about your profile, which was available on Facebook.
Yeah, so it connects to your Facebook profile. And then it was harvesting your data and your friends' data that had open settings and people were not aware.
Yes.
And that data was meant to be destroyed after the personality app shut down or whatever. But that data was then sold to Cambridge Analytica, who used that to inform their targeted political ads in the Trump campaign and Brexit.
Yeah.
So how Cambridge Analytica claimed that they were able to create these personality demographics.
Exactly.
And they used the data that was essentially stolen against Facebook's terms and services to better target you for political ads. So if they might say, okay, this personality subsection is people that are afraid of immigration, and they would just bombard you with anti-immigration ads, essentially.
Yes.
The whistleblower came out and was like, we knew exactly how often to target you with those ads and when. He said it was like the perfect propaganda machine. It was a full-stack propaganda machine.
Yeah, I think what's even more like terrifying about it is that they just went one level deeper and they didn't even say like, okay, this person really hates immigration, let's plug in with anti-immigration stuff. They use like the latest, you know, science around psychology and influence to go, this is the exact type of emotion. You know, when you think of that Simon Sinek video and The Power of Why, it was like a TED Talk that went viral. He talks about like the limbic system. So the most primitive part of our brain is that reptilian brain. And that's that sort of fight and flight response.
Yeah.
And what they wanted to do was basically push to the limit. Like, what are the emotional responses that trigger people the most? And let's mess around with them. So let's play on people's fear of, you know, losing their home. Let's play on people's love for their country and for patriotism. And we all learned about propaganda when we were at school. And what's so messed up about this is that, you know, we've got had so many advances in science and technology. So you can do propaganda in a way more sophisticated way. And as that documentary showed, when they were on hidden camera, all the directors of Cambridge Analytica were like, see, the thing is, as soon as people know it's propaganda, they won't listen to it. So you have to be subtle. You have to be subtle. And that's what's terrifying. Which is why it's so difficult to disseminate between real and fake news, because the people that produce fake news are going to such great lengths to make you realize that it's not fake news. That said, I think it's like interesting to remember that the majority of people listening to this podcast, let's face it, will probably not be swayed by any of the campaigns by Cambridge Analytica. That is the argument I would like to make. I would like to think that I would... if faced with an advert like, oh, Jeremy Corbyn is a socialist, he partied with Stalin.
I think it's interesting because this is obviously very much a right-leaning campaigns that have used this data.
Yes, Steve Bannon used them as well.
But I'm more concerned about the techniques and what power lies in the hands of propagandists, essentially. So there may be a situation where, you know, a more left-leaning campaign may use it. And of course, you know, generally speaking, I'm sure most people listening to this might be more left-leaning. So we might not necessarily mind that. But just in terms of the principle of how we can be manipulated.
Yeah, definitely.
It's frightening, to be honest. Like, and
well, I want to know who's going to delete Facebook. That's the start. Because let's face
let's keep it real. Nobody's... It's not. It's too late now.
Like, too late.
Let's keep it 100. Oh. It's too late now. We're all plugged in. If you're going to be on Instagram, and if you're in the UK, you're probably going to be on WhatsApp. So Facebook has their tentacles firmly embedded in you. Let's
so
keep
you
it
don't
100.
Mind. You don't mind that Facebook.
No,
I
do mind.
Without your permission, I do willingly mind. Gave your data and your friend's data away so that you could be manipulated.
I do mind. I think it's terrible. I'm just thinking about what can be done, and you know, are we going to get all 1. Whatever billion people to delete Facebook? Is that going to happen? No.
Slowly over time.
Yeah, man. Maybe they get MySpace. I hope so. To be honest, because I don't know if I hope so. They're a complicated company. They do many things that are good. You know, I know a lot of people that are reunited with family and friends, blah, 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 blah.
But they also do a lot of stuff which is just downright evil. And I think we need to hold people accountable to it, like particularly tech companies. There's so much ignorance and naivety around data. And like, this is like big data gone wrong. And it's only going to get worse as AI gets better. And we put more of our lives into big data. We all have smart home devices. We're using Siri. We have laptops. We have phones. We're tracked all the time. Really, I just want to almost just like appeal to people, like ensure that you are having these conversations with people that you care about. Because as much as we might be like, okay, yeah, whatever, Facebook is here to stay, I'm going to update my settings, there are so many people that don't think about that and don't think about like the amount of control and sharing they give to the social media platforms and platforms in general that they use.
Gonna sound like a straight out communist, but yeah, the government's got to get involved and do something. And for example, if there's a political ad on TV, it specifically says this is a political ad paid for and purchased by, you know, X, for example, in the States and in the UK. But for whatever reason, if there's a political ad on my Facebook timeline, there's no regulation regarding that. How can that be? Facebook have, you know, their motto is move fast and break things. And that's got them from, you know, a guy's dorm in Harvard to being a multi, you know, billion dollar company. You know, shout out to Mark Zuckerberg in that sense. He's an amazing executor. But that motto of move fast and break things, you're now breaking democracy, essentially. Because now, you know, you're letting anybody purchase any kind of advertisement, essentially. And this is now being used to sway elections. There has to be some regulation. There has to be some kind of like grey writing on top saying this is a political ad paid for by this company, this entity. And shout out to Jason Calacanis. This is his idea. He says also, like, if you're going to buy a Facebook ad, there has to be, like, your ID, like, your passport.
Yeah, for sure.
I can boost, for example, like, any Facebook post that I do, or you can as well, on your Facebook page. It's so seamless because they want to make as much money as possible. They let it so easily to use their paid products. And it shouldn't be that easy. There should be more friction. You have to put your passport in. Yeah. You have to say where it's coming from. Definitely with political stuff. You know, if Nike's selling their trainers or whatever on the platform, God bless, I don't care. You know, they want to propagandize their products, that's cool. But you can't propagandize political messaging that easily. And that's what's happening so far. So it's a mess. And Facebook on their own volition is not going to do that. No company will self-regulate in that sense. I don't think they will. Unless they're put under an amazing amount of pressure.
It seems to happen all the time in technology that everything's moving very fast, you know, developing exponentially. infiltrating almost in quite an insidious way into our lives. And then the government plays catch up. And let's face it, the government has enough on its plate before it starts worrying about this. And I think what's so challenging around technology is that, like, even when things go wrong, it's still a bit intangible. It still seems a bit far away. You know, if a bridge collapses and I can't drive from A to B, I'm going to call my local MP and be like, yo, get on the problem. But with this, it's
and
just
the engineer,
like,
at hand will be held responsible, or the construction people, for example.
Exactly. The accountability is clear.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, what's really frustrating with the whole Facebook thing is that who are we going to blame? Facebook will say, oh, it's the algorithm and everyone is free. Or, oh, well, it's the data and you opted in to share it. Mm. Cambridge Analytica was going to be like, I mean, they've already been to Parliament and denied any wrongdoing.
Yeah, it was an out-and-out lie. They asked them, have you used Facebook data? And the CEO, some attorney in Tuff, I couldn't have made up a better bad guy, to be honest, that hurt me down to my bones. He was like, no, we don't. It was an out-and-out lie. The whistleblower came out and was like, that was a lie. And that was part of the reason why he came out and decided to do that one.
Let's not be surprised when rich white guys with lots of influence and lots of connections lie.
Definitely.
In fact, I just assume that they're lying until proven otherwise. Because that's the world I grew up in. Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky.
Sexual relations with that woman.
No, the one that got me was that he put the joint in his mouth and didn't inhale.
Oh, I didn't inhale. They asked Obama, he was like, yeah, I smoked that.
Yeah.
And in his biography, like, he admitted to, like, cocaine use, like, so.
But yeah, what I mean to say is, you know, we should be, I want to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to write to my local MP, and I'm going to be like, bring this debate up in Parliament again. What's the controls happening on big data? We all need to do it, even though we don't necessarily see Facebook as the villain, because we're opening up Messenger to plan what to do with our friends tonight, or we're reminded that it's our aunt's birthday and we're sending her a message. Flashbacks to old photos that make us feel good about ourselves. Facebook is the villain. Facebook is like that Two-Face or whatever from Batman.
They are absolutely the villain.
Not just in this story, like, they are always the villain. You can't be sometimes the good guy and sometimes the bad guy. You are always that thing, in my opinion. And I don't want people to forget that.
I just wish there was an option where I could give Facebook $5 a year.
A year?
Ain't nothing. Don't give me a month. I'm not doing a month. Hell no. $5 a year. No. But what I'm saying is $5 a year, and I can opt out of, like, you can't target me. You don't have my data for your recommendation engine for advertisers. Just, I want out. I just want to use your service and pay for it. And I'm no longer the product. Because the cliche goes, if you're not paying for the product, you are the product, essentially.
Yeah.
That's what people say. It's a tired old phrase now, but it's true. And I want to be able to opt out and say, okay, I'll give you money. Leave me alone. I want to use your service. I want to, you know, like my friend's picture. I want to whatever, whatever. And the beat of that, as far as I'm concerned, is there's only ever going to be a small minority of people that would do that. So it won't really affect their business. Like, so what if you, instead of having 1.3 billion people to target, you have 1.2 or 1.1? Like,
shareholders will like that. Shareholders will not like that, yeah. As we spoke about earlier with profit. What if we lived in a world where profit didn't just mean the cash that's left over after all your costs and blah, 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 blah? What if profit also meant that, like, it included a component of how you're actually, like, helping people's lives and then was reduced by the negative ways in which you're impacting people's lives? Because what happens is we just judge these companies, like you were saying earlier, by the money they make and what they can give back to their shareholders. We're not judging them by all the other chaos and sadness and, you know, that they create. Like, Trump was elected. Now, I'm not saying Cambridge Analytica and the Facebook data breach were the only reasons Trump got elected. We also have to be realistic here, right?
I don't necessarily know if that's how unrealistic that is. Because
really?
The election was swung. There are certain swing states, and I'm not an expert in this kind of stuff, but there are certain swing states, and it can come down to 200,000, 300,000 people sometimes. Okay. And those people might have been swayed by political ads that they've seen on Facebook, fake news. So I'm not saying that it's like definitely, but I'm just not saying it's outside of the realm of possibility, because 200,000 people can be swayed to purchase a product.
Yes.
On Facebook. Yes. So can they be swayed on that day? Oh, you know what? Hillary Clinton is a liar, for example.
Yeah.
I don't like her.
But, you know, people have always been manipulated anyway. Like, this is maybe the most sophisticated type of manipulation
scale,
we have ever seen.
Not.
There is a certain subsect of the population which is just more prone to being manipulated. That's just the reality. And we've always existed there. So I think, you know, I'm not saying this isn't a bad thing. This is obviously a really bad thing, and we need to like scrutinize it, and we need to hold the companies accountable to it. But I'm also saying like there are also some people that just voted for Trump because they wanted to vote for Trump.
Oh yeah, yeah, no doubt.
And there are also some people who are going alt-right because they want to go alt-right.
Yeah. I'm not. Yeah, we can't take away the responsibility.
So you kind of like have
people.
To like line up a lot of things for them to really have swung the election. It would have to be that they could influence the swing voters in the swing states, and then that made it happen.
I mean, one point. Trump underspent Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton spent most of her money on TV ads, and he spent most of his money on Facebook and social media ads. And, okay, maybe not Facebook by themselves, but social media. Trump wouldn't have been elected without social media, because he was able to bypass the TV channels and just tweet whatever recklessness he wanted and then dominate the news cycle. He was given a speakerphone to the whole world via Twitter, via Facebook. So maybe not just Facebook is the only villain here, just generally the mode in which we communicate now, social media, is what elected him. He wouldn't have been elected.
I'm just going to say something, devil's advocate, like not even devil's advocate, just my true opinion. Like, yes, that could be a reasonable thesis that should be looked further into, but the US is also a patriarchy, like, and maybe the country was just not ready for a woman.
Yeah, it's multifaceted. There are sexists, there are racists that wanted to vote for Trump, but social media made it easier for him. That's the only point I'll make. I'm not saying that it's the deciding factor, but it definitely made it easier for him. And I don't think he would have had an easier time if he had to go through just the normal news channels. He dominated the news cycles, the news cycle all the time, because he would tweet something crazy and then they would be like, the whole day would be Trump. And it got his message out there to target those who are sexist, racist, homophobe, whatever. But
do you think that political consultancies then should be banned from helping political parties during elections or helping politicians? Because if you think about it, I mean, Cambridge Analytica, I don't even want to know how much they charge. But a part of me would love to conduct a social experiment where I hire Cambridge Analytica to convince like the most militant misogynists to become feminists. I want to be like, who are like the swing voting domestic abusers and players out there? Let's like send them some ads. Let's turn them into women lovers. I don't know if it's possible, but you know, with the big bucks, if someone wants to fund this,
you got 100 mil.
Down this route. But yeah, like should we be living in a society where political consultancies can't do their dirty work? Because I think what the last 12 months has showed us is that there are businesses operating within capitalism that exist to do evil things. Harvey Weinstein had that company of people that would basically undermine the accounts and reputations of all the women that he sexually assaulted, sexually abused, and raped.
That's mad.
So when they came out and were like, yo, Harvey Weinstein raped me, he put them on the case, paid them thousands of money, and suddenly they'd be like digging up all these fake stories about blah, 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 whatever. Mm. Now we find out that we've got companies that are colluding with tech firms that have taken our data without our permission to use sophisticated technology and like manipulate us into doing stuff. Like we're little lab rats, so that like other super rich people can just have even more influence. It's a scary, scary time to be participating in capitalism, honestly, because I know I'm at the bottom of the pile and I'm not even at the bottom-mist of the pile. Mm. And it's just terrifying and sobering when you take a step back and realize a minority of people are running the show and pulling the strings. And the one last thing we had, this exercising of our democratic rights, even that now has been taken away from us.
Mm, yeah, I mean,
should I just give up? Should I just go to Mars?
The whole political consultant thing, should they be banned? I think political consultants are, I would call them a lagging indicator of the problem. They are a problem, but they are not the cause of the problem. The cause of the problem is the amount of money in politics. So large corporations, rich individuals, they finance elections. Because they want things in return. They want a return on investment, whether that's a tax cut. So you have hundreds of millions. I think in the last election, billions were spent. And even Obama spent $1 billion. So, and I love Obama, but let's not pretend that he was above the system. He was a part of the system.
Of course.
And when that kind of money is sloshing through the system, people get paid. Consultants have to be brought in. Make sure we win this by any means necessary. So the consultants are there as a result and a consequence of out and out corruption of the political system, specifically in the States and here as well. So anyway, we can be here all day.
We're here all
day. This is not political-ish, this is tech-ish. So let's go on to our next disaster.
Let's go. Oh gosh, so many. Tech, what
another
are you
loser.
Like? Tech,
another loser.
What are you like this week? We got to go to Snapchat and the re-review.
You want to do the Snapchat one?
Mate, we have to. For the record, if this happened under my watch, not that Snapchat is under my watch, I'd have quit that company.
Thank you.
So for anyone who didn't know, Snapchat debuted. What was this, a game?
I don't know. It was
Would You Rather. And the choices were punch Chris Brown or slap Rihanna. Okay. Now, for anyone who was checked out of pop culture news, we all know that Rihanna and Chris Brown are exes. Rihanna missed the Grammys a few years ago because she was involved in an argument with Chris Brown where he subsequently physically attacked her.
Yeah, abused her.
So, you know, there's a history of domestic violence in that relationship. Rihanna went to police, reported the crime. The photos went viral. Really brought to light the fact that doesn't matter where you are in your life, you can still be the victim of abuse.
Mm.
And immediately the public just responded and were like, no, Snapchat, what are you thinking? This is in poor taste. This is inappropriate. Mm. This isn't even funny. Snapchat, pull the ad, profusely apologize. And I'm just like, come on, Snapchat.
And even Rihanna came out and was like,
no,
I don't even like this app. What you like?
Oh yeah, they lost money on the stock market again. After Kylie Jenner now
dropped 6%. Yeah, so it's another repeat of power of influencers to kind of move the markets. And yeah, I don't know what Snapchat was thinking.
Can I just say as well, like, you're telling me there wasn't a single Rihanna fan, single woman, single, even person of color probably, that went through the process in which that ad was created, reviewed, assembled, made, reviewed again,
put
live. Come on, guys.
I think it was they're moving towards more of a self-service ad platform. So I don't think anybody at Snapchat had anything to do with it. I'm not defending Snapchat. I'm just making the point that when you have these kind of self-service ad platforms, similar to Facebook, this is the kind of, pardon my French, fuckery that can happen. And yeah, I don't have any sympathy for Snapchat. They fucked up. I mean, they've apologized and their stock has dipped. It's just a PR disaster after PR disaster for them, really. What's the lesson of this? I don't even know what to say, really. It's just a disaster.
I mean, you know, you were talking about Jason Kalanakis saying that people shouldn't be able to buy Facebook ads without giving some form of ID because they're creating political ads that aren't subject to regulation. Well, why don't we make, you know, even user-generated content and user-generated stuff more accountable? Because the thing is, the internet has changed so much, right? 10, 15 years ago, people weren't consuming 99.9% of the data they used to make decisions from one or two social media platforms, right? They weren't. But the reality is now they are. So if the only things you're checking are Facebook and Snapchat on any given day, I know you're not reading the news. I'm barely reading the news.
Yeah.
I know you're not watching them on TV or whatever. Maybe we should make the people that run these systems, but also that participate in these systems, a bit more accountable to the content they're creating. Because there are impressionable minds out there.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about Snapchat is I read that their revenue from advertising is going to overtake Twitter this year.
That's an indication that Twitter is struggling, or...
Well, I mean, it's a funny one with Twitter because Twitter's always been struggling, hasn't it?
I love Twitter. That's the thing, though. It's like it's done me so good over my career, and it's so important. Like, I would hate to see it go away, but it's just can't get its act together as a business.
Maybe it'll turn to subscription model one day.
They should do. Or maybe it should just should be bought out by some kind of... You know the way the Guardian is owned in a non-profit way, and it's, you know, it's donations and stuff. Maybe Twitter should be, it's almost like a public good to a certain extent.
Or like Wikipedia,
essentially, like a charity, like maybe a non-profit. Perhaps I don't know, but yeah, going back to the whole Rihanna situation, it's just a debacle, really.
I think
it's just another disaster for Snapchat, and obviously, you know, forget on a business side of things, you know, people that have suffered from domestic abuse and stuff. It's just nasty all round.
Yeah, it's not something to joke about. That's a real thing. And I think we know that we have the technology to review stuff automatically. Like, I appreciate Snapchat is growing at scale like any other startup. They're giving people more and more opportunity to self-serve themselves with their advertising platform. But they must have some system for, like, flagging or reporting, like, abusive posts. Like, every company uses some variation of AI to do that.
I'm sure they do, but all it takes now is somebody to screenshot it, put it on Twitter, and it goes viral. So maybe there would have been some kind of, you know, something going on within the official channels at Snapchat, but it was just too late.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's the danger with self-service ad platforms. This is what it is.
Yeah.
You want to scale as quickly as possible, make as much money as quickly as possible. You want it to be frictionless. And the danger is that, you know, you're going to get some crud on your on the platform.
Yes.
But let's go on to Theranos.
Please.
Yeah, we've...
I hand you the floor.
So Theranos, talked about this actually a few episodes back, talking about fraudulent startups. Theranos was founded by a woman called Elizabeth Holmes as a 19-year-old Stanford graduate. She dropped out. Another, you know, legendary dropout.
Riches, she claimed riches.
That it's a biotech company. She claimed that with a small prick of your finger, she could get a drop of blood and do all kinds of crazy analysis that would currently require you to give out, you know, a proper blood test. and the company's been around for years and years, and they've had all these lucrative corporate partnerships and whatnot, but the product hasn't lived up to the bill. It's actually turned out to be a fraud, essentially. Product's a fraud. The revenue numbers that she said to raise money was all fraudulent, and she was kind of proclaimed as like the next Steve Jobs. She kind of played up. She used to wear the black polo neck, and she was on the front cover of magazines, Inc. magazine. Mm. And I actually read an interesting Inc. magazine article where they were kind of apologizing and saying, we built her up without doing the due diligence.
Yeah.
We said she's the next this, she's the next that.
Happens a lot in our internet.
Yeah, and we're living in a world now where, you know, it's a blogger-driven world where everybody wants to have the next hit, the next article.
Yes.
So if you can get the scoop, exclusive scoop by speaking to the next hot entrepreneur, you'll do it. And, you know, I run a media company, and it's hard when you're limited resources to do all the research that you need to do to go into the company accounts. Is this company real? There has been some exposés done by some real journalistic entities that exposed them a couple of years ago. Now the SEC charged them with out-and-out fraud. So what does it say? Like, are we too quick to proclaim people? It was almost too good to be true. Like, here's a woman, entrepreneur, she's killing it, she's going to be the next Steve Jobs. And we bought into the fairy tale, and it's... What's the moral of the story? Like, what do we take from this?
I mean, where does the accountability really fall? Because let's face it, if she was a 19-year-old Stanford dropout, then she would have been depending a lot on the advice of her VCs, any advisors that they put on her board.
But she defrauded them.
People that they hired. No. But come on now. Let's also be realistic about how decisions within a startup are made.
Mm.
Right? A CEO does not monopolize information in a startup.
Mm.
He might monopolize decision-making and power, but he does not monopolize information.
Mm.
If she, like, you know, if she was building this, you know, she would have been doing R&D. She would have had to come up with an MVP. She would have had to conduct a beta test. She would have had to create results. She would have had to show those results to initial investors, try and raise another round of funding as she went for a scale.
Mm.
There would have also have had to been like some customers that legit bought the product and used the product and got some kind of results. Like, I'm not saying that she hasn't conducted fraud, but I think the scale at which the fraud has happened is not solely down to her, because there had to have been other people involved.
Yeah.
And this is where I think like it's important for us to, you know, sometimes put some of this accountability onto the investors as well and onto the board members as well, because it's so easy to scapegoat founders. You know, when Uber got in trouble, oh yeah, let's get rid of, what's his name, Trevor?
Travis Kalanick? Yeah. No. Kalanick, I'm getting confused. Yeah.
Travis Kalanick, oh yeah.
Kalanick, there we go.
You see, what investors do when the times are good is laud and praise the founder. You the man. Watch. If another Cambridge Analytica thinks, we will watch the fall of Mark Zuckerberg. They can do it slowly over time, because it comes down to who has the money.
Mm.
And what happens with Theranos is the people who are also helping her make decisions, who also have a stake in this company, were fine with the fraud. You know why they were fine with fraud? Because that's not the first company they've done it in before.
Mm.
These are tactics which are well used. Let's not be naive.
I think you're right. I might have been a bit harsh. If you're a 19-year-old and you come with a product that you may have oversold to a certain extent in terms of its capabilities, the quote-unquote grown-ups in the room should have said, actually, can we see this? Does this work properly?
Look, what's Facebook going on? Facebook stole the idea from the Winklevoss twins and Severin.
Yeah. I think settled it in a legal, you know what, the thing dispute. Is that the attitude in the startup world is, you know, like I said, move fast, break things. And there's a very much, not a fake it till you make it culture, but you can use those words if you want. And when you're building software, like a website or an app, you can get away with it. We're going to build the features later on.
There's a lot of smoke and mirrors, for sure.
100%, like. But when you start going into the world of biotech, where there's actual health implications now, you can't do that.
Especially this whole data ethos,
this whole, you know, hustle, and you know, we'll figure it out. Listen, when you're doing real hardware that's to do with people's health, you know,
life or death,
the attitude's got to change, and I think it's a wake up call to a certain extent.
I definitely think that some VCs are more scrupulous than others, and like some VCs are more ethical than others. When we have these cases blow up, like we see with Cambridge Analytica and Facebook, like we see with Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes, we have to remember that these are just the ones that we were able to catch, right?
Mm.
So Cambridge Analytica and Facebook data breach, we had this incredible combination of circumstances where the chief data scientist, what's his name, Christopher Wiley, he quit the company, they sued him, he came out and bred everything. Then we also had the Observer Guardian journalist doing the undercover sting for over 3 years. Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes. I don't know who Elizabeth Holmes potentially didn't sleep with to get herself out of this issue. I'm being realistic, man. I'm saying it.
Said that.
Because there are other people who have done fraudulent things, borderline fraudulent things. They didn't get caught. Like, I remember watching the Panorama about the LIBOR scandal. I know I'm going on a tangent here, but just bear with me. LIBOR is the interest rate at which banks lend money to other banks.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
And around the time of the credit crunch, they fixed this rate to basically make their books look better.
Mm.
So all the big banks in London, potentially in collusion with the Bank of England, basically agreed that they would not follow the market, but rather set the rate because they were all short on their cash reserves, mm-hmm. the markets were plunging. And behind closed doors, over expensive sushi lunches and playing at the squash court, whatever, our money was lost.
Mm.
We, the taxpayers, took the cost of this scandal. Those men walk free.
Mm.
Okay, those men are dancing in the Cayman Islands, flying on their private jets.
Mm.
We broke. Northern Rock collapsed.
Mm.
People lost their pensions. So again, you know, the dazzling lights of capitalism and consumption and fun, la la la. Evil stuff is always happening. And
so you're saying she's kind of the fall person.
Yes.
As in, like, she shouldn't be.
Playing devil. Like, think she's, I'm not even playing devil advocate. That is honestly what I believe. It's easy for her. She is a woman. People are always looking for a woman to hate on anyway, from my perspective.
She's a scapegoat, basically. And it's an unfair spotlight on this one instance of fraud.
I'm just saying that she cannot have monopolized the decision making in this scenario. She cannot have. So you're telling me she made the executive decision on how the technology is built.
But don't get twisted. How if you're it works. There's a reason why people want to be the founder. It's because when the times are good, you're the one on the magazine
of
covers, all right? But when the times are bad, the buck stops with you.
Let's keep it real. The buck. 100%. That is the risk and the reward of being the CEO. But I just hope that the FCC investigation into fraud extends to all the other decision makers and stakeholders.
Do you know how bad it was? Like, I think at one point, she said that I'm not going to say she said, it's a corporation, it's a company. Mm. So they said that their revenue was around 100,000. Tens of millions. It was actually 100,000.
Oh my God. What?
They did that to defraud, to raise capital, essentially.
How can you even? Wow, that is just next level.
Because the culture is whatever it takes to raise this money and get to the next round.
Mm.
It's okay. We're gonna build the product out. It's gonna be there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and listen. You know they called what's that thing about Steve Jobs? The reality distortion field. He had an amazing way of basically making things appear to be what they weren't yet. Come with us. We're building this great product. Yeah, it doesn't exist yet, but we're going to make it.
Believe
it's going to be amazing.
Me.
Believe in me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of part of the mythos of being a founder. You have to believe in things that are not yet there because you're going to make it happen.
Yeah, of course.
And this is where it goes too far. This is where it goes too far.
You can't just make up how much money
you're
making.
Tens of millions, you know. Meanwhile, you got 100K in the bank. Nah, it's mad.
Yeah. That's kind of crazy. Well, like,
let's see how it plays out.
One thing that I think is like kind of interesting to observe, full disclosure, I work at AngelList, is how they want to build systems that give you more transparency as an investor over like company metrics.
Because
let's face it, like right now, you are literally just taking the founder's word for it. If you and I start a VC fund right now and you're like, okay, yeah, we're writing checks for $500,000. Come on, come on. Let's see what you got.
Yeah.
They're just going to pull up a slide, show me some graph. Everything's going up and up and up, and I'll be okay, let's do this.
Money. You know what's really cool, actually? You know Indie Hackers?
Yeah.
So Indie Hackers, if you're listening at home, is a website where people bootstrap companies. They don't take any outside investment, and they're quite famous for, like, you have to display your revenue numbers.
Yes.
So what they did is they had a Stripe verified revenue number, so you could have like a little blue tick saying this revenue is verified by Stripe,
which I think
is really cool, because a lot of these other guys might just be like, yeah, we're doing 20K a week. You might have done 20K once in a week, and then you're saying, that's what we're doing, you know.
But that's my MRR.
Yeah, so people like Stripe, that's actually quite a massive opportunity for Stripe, really.
Well, they acquired Indie Hackers.
I mean, just generally to be able to say this revenue is verified.
Right, yes.
Yeah, to like work with VCs and angel investors.
Stripe, if you're listening.
Yeah. I don't know how it would work logistically, but...
Well, they do have access to that data. I guess maybe startups could opt in to like let startups...
Yeah.
Like, basically, they could share their Stripe dashboard.
Basically. I'm sure it does happen, though. I'm sure it does happen from time to time.
That's amazing. Yeah. I actually shout out Indie Hackers and like Cortland and all the stories that are shared in that community. Like Michael said, they're I know that we're not the only people that get frustrated by like the hype and the success bias that happens in tech, because Indie Hackers would not be as popular as it is if that weren't the case. So all the stories, there are people who are bootstrapping, people that didn't go down the VC route, and there's like incredible success shared there.
You know what the thing is, this whole, you know, proclaiming founders and having them on magazine covers, what I would say that does not upset me, but I find frustrating, is that when you are a founder and you're struggling and you haven't raised money or whatever, you kind of, some people find it inspirational, others find it quite depressing. You're like, why am I not doing what they're doing?
This person's doing.
And it turns out that this person is an out-and-out fraud. Or yeah, it's like, exactly. It's all like, you know, how many people might have read that article and got inspired, but how many might have read that article and been like, wow, she's 19, she's raising all this money, and we've got this whole success porn, essentially, and how much due diligence has the writer of the article done to find out, well, is this actually true? Yeah. Have you actually done this? Like, what is the case here?
I know. So, I'm actually,
something, it's food for thought. I'm not saying we should stop everything, but like, in that sense, but like, it's something to think about.
I'm going to like say something provocative.
Go on.
The way that these publications work is selling stories that people want to hear, right? They need to put people on the cover that are going to sell copies.
Yeah.
I actually think that this is a tactic by media publications to create a media cycle. Because if you look at the success rate of hottest founder of the moment, you know, the probability that they remain the hottest founder of the moment over the next 6 months, a year, 2 years is so friggin' low.
Yeah.
So what you can do then is go, oh my God, look, they're the hottest founder of the moment. They're going to be the biggest success story. And then just wait until they inevitably fail or mess up or get involved in some kind of public dispute and then put them on the cover again and be like, oh, how the mighty have fallen.
Yeah.
I'm just saying it's a formula. It's a formula and it happens all the time.
Yes. I mean, it happens in a celebrity world as well. They love to see you rise and they can't wait to be like...
Oh, this couple just got married. Oh, now they're getting divorced. Or like, it's a ploy and we fall for it every time. Just like we fall for the Cambridge Analytica heart tugs, pulling
up heartstrings. So it's all our fault, is what we're saying. It is our fault.
Well, society is a reflection of our actions. The media is a reflection of our desires. We all play a role in this.
Yeah. I'm a believer that, I'll quote Men in Black, Tommy Lee Jones. He says that, you know, a person is smart, but people can be quite stupid in a group setting.
Agreed.
But yeah, like as the masses, we can be swayed quite easily into mob mentalities. Whereas an individual sat you down and said, we all have an intellectual discussion on a one-on-one basis. But let's talk about Uber next. This is another disaster.
I can't believe this. Do you know what?
I think I've got a bit of a contrarian take on this, by the way. I think most people are going to be a bit shocked.
Well, let's just paint the scene. An Uber self-driving SUV, which also had a driver in the car, hit a middle-aged woman crossing the street. I think she was holding her bike, wasn't she?
Yeah.
And she passed away. So we've had the first death from an Uber self-driving car.
Or from any self-driving car.
Oh, yeah, any self-driving car.
I think there was somebody that died in a Tesla, but they were meant to...
They were meant to die?
No, it was...
I was like, whoa.
It was on autopilot mode, whereas the Uber car was meant to be completely self-driving. So this is the first car that it was like, it had a driver in a seat, but it was meant to be self-driving. Versus he put it on autopilot mode when it wasn't meant to be on autopilot mode.
Right, okay,
and that's how he passed away.
But so the first death by a self-driving car.
Yeah.
Murder, if we personify the car, will eventually.
I don't know if murder is, because if you get into a car accident and somebody passes away, it's not necessarily murder, is it?
It's homicide, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's an accident, yeah. I don't know the legal framework. I've seen some people online saying, and not necessarily tech people, where they're like, what the hell? Like, there's self-driving cars on the road already? Like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
Like, it's a no for me. Like, this shouldn't be happening. I'll let you take the floor first, then I'll have my say.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, great. So, first of all, it's really sad, and condolences to the family involved. Yeah. I just think it clearly, from what I can see, could have been prevented. Mm. I need to do more research into it.
Yeah, I think the details haven't been exposed yet.
Yeah.
It's a criminal investigation. And
of course.
Condolences to the family, like you said.
From what I understand, self-driving cars are at a point where they're being tested in a wide degree. We have autonomous heavy goods vehicles on the motorways in America. Mm. Lots of tests are being conducted in the UK. They've still not been approved by any governments to be on the road. So, like, if you're listening and worrying about your safety, trust me, you should be fine.
Mm.
But because they're at this place where they can be autonomous, but there has to be a driver in the car. And I think it's probably realistically going to stay that way for at least the remainder of this year, if not, it's well into next year. Here's why I think this is sad for progress. Like, we spoke about in previous podcasts, anytime things change, we as a people, as a race, as a species, humanity, get nervous because we don't like change. Change is a threat to our existence and well-being a lot of the time. We need to adapt accordingly, and sometimes we don't adapt successfully. With autonomous vehicles, this could be, probably will be, one of the biggest changes in our lifetime.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Think of how it's going to change, you know, how we go about doing stuff, how we get from A to B, the time that it will free up.
And so what much we human time will be freed up.
Put that time into is just incredible. And I guess I'm concerned that people will use this as an opportunity to halt the progress of autonomous vehicles.
I think you're right. I think a lot of this depends on public sentiment. And if there's a few more of these accidents, then it may very well slow down the process from a legal point of view to get the government permission to allow self-driving cars on the road. And I think it's a failure of the human mind in the sense that, so for example, I read up 16 people a day die from car accidents.
A day?
16, yeah, 1/6 in the world, yeah.
It's actually less than I thought.
Yeah, I mean, this is with all the safety precautions that have been put in, seatbelts, for example, and speed bumps and whatever. It doesn't make the news. So, but the human mind is attracted to this one story. This is the first and only. I mean, and you'd have to compare it mile for mile. So how many miles of driving does a self-driving car have to do before there's an accident versus a human driven car? And still the most dangerous thing that we do on a day-to-day basis is get in a car and walk across the street. Like, the accident level is still quite high. So I hope you're right. I hope it doesn't steamroll and stop the progression of self-driving cars. I mean, self-driving cars in themselves are a whole number of topic, because there's going to be a lot of economic displacement. I think the number one job for, I don't know if it's white males or middle-aged males, I can't remember what it was in the States, is truck driver.
Oh yeah, there's it's been one, a lot
yeah, so a lot of people like that. And you know, you can have this Luddite conversation again, and you're right, there will be new employment, but there will be a period of time where there will be some displacement.
It's basically,
and the lobby against
the
self-driving cars will get stronger, the truck unions, health and safety advocates, perhaps.
But I think that's like actually like a legit concern, because what's unique in the truck driving things, like in the past I have said that economic displacement is difficult to measure because new jobs are created. But what's unique about truck drivers in America is that it's one of the few jobs that requires like a relatively low level of formal education, but pays significantly well just because of the nature of the role.
Yeah, it's a very
not a comfortable job. So, you know, for a certain bracket of the middle class in America, it's just a perfect job because, you know, you can provide for your family. And I don't know of any job that tech is creating that requires that same combination. You know what I mean? Like that level of skill and that amount of compensation. No way.
It doesn't exist. Do you know Yuval Noah Harari? He's the author of it's like every tech bro's favorite book, Sapiens. It's a really good book.
Oh yeah, I'm reading Homo Deus right now.
Yeah, so he talks about in Homo Deus, so for example, technology will displace jobs, but it also will create jobs, just like you said. But will the textile worker in Bangladesh be able to be the creator of virtual worlds or AI, create AI? It's not going to be the same person. They will probably end up doing a job that's less paid and more lower down on the economic scale. Same for these truck drivers. So
what's the name of that guy who was a founder at Facebook and now runs his own VC firm? Chamath.
Oh yeah, Chamath. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I can't pronounce his surname. If someone's like Sri Lankan, I'm better at pronouncing it.
I was gonna make a stab at it, but I won't do it. Yeah, he's a gangster, man. I love watching his talks.
He's such an OG.
Yeah,
so
we talked about him in episode one, his little talk.
One of the things that I feel that talk that he does at Stanford Business School gave me a tool with which to understand the world around me better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because in it, he talks about how he realized early on that there's a small number of people, and they are white men, sorry, other white men who feel like I'm focusing on you, and they get to make the decisions about the world. You know, people like the Koch brothers, Rupert Murdoch, they are just so rich and so powerful. They are shaping the world to their image, what they want. They're like almost like gods, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so what's so interesting then about this example, you say like, okay, you know, will this person in Bangladesh create the virtual world we live in? I think it's really unrealistic for us to think that power and influence as it stands now is radically going to change in our lifetime. I really think it's unrealistic to think that. I think we can challenge it and combat it and hold it accountable to other things and try to break up to that level. But let's all remember like where it really falls, and therefore put that accountability on them to not only build the world in their vision, but also include us within it, which is why the movement behind inclusion is so important.
It's complicated because the truck driving incidents, that's going to be one of the first iterations where we'll see self-driving cars, because the economic incentive is so great, basically, for the people who control industry to get rid of the drivers. It's much more cheaper for them to have self-driving cars.
Yeah.
So I don't think this will slow down self-driving cars, this accident, this unfortunate accident, because the interests of capital will be so great that it won't stop. We call it progress, but essentially what it is that, and it is technological progress, but it's generally technological progress that benefits those who are investors, owners, and they will push hard. There will not be any strong, like the truck union lobby will not be able to stop the owners of capital. And I'm not necessarily saying this is a bad thing per se. I'm always in favor of new technology. I see technology as a net good, generally speaking, on average. And that's a whole other can of worms we can talk about another time. But it's going to be interesting. Like, I think a friend of mine said, he thinks that in the next 30, 50 years, like one of the biggest, the way we have the debate about guns in America, the next big debate will be like, I want to drive my car. And people are like, no, you can't drive anymore. Like, everything has to be self-automated now because it's just too dangerous. Yeah. People will be like, no, I want to drive. Like, and people will be like, oh, this is like the human-driven section. And it'll become a big dislike.
Because
there are people that really F with their cars. They love driving cars. And there'll be some of us that are just like, can we just get around safely? Because it's too, like, you know. So it'll be interesting to see the next 30 years what really happens.
That's so interesting. So can you imagine a world where when we have kids, they'll be like, oh my God, I can't believe you used to drive cars, you're such losers. And then by the time they're teenagers, there'll be like people that are just like, yo, check out my Prius.
Yeah,
like,
it'll be
retro.
so antiquated. Yeah,
and
like,
they'll be like, yo, is that autonomous? No, man, self-driving. They'll be like, what, are you driving yourself?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. In the next 100 years, there probably won't be any human drivers anymore.
Yeah.
And it will create industries, because if you're thinking about it, if I'm going from A to B, I no longer have to focus on the road. I can just sit back in my passenger seat and I'll need entertainment. I'll need Netflix.
We can redesign cars.
Yeah, exactly.
You have a swimming pool in your car.
Yeah,
you can literally like, just yoga, have like, Pilates, let's go.
And I think when self-driving cars will become much, much safer is when all the cars around it are self-driving also, so that they will all have software that where they can communicate with each other. So there won't be a situation where, you know, so if you can imagine traffic, if they're all cars are communicating with each other, they can synchronize and there won't be traffic jams. Whereas now, in the intermediate section where we have human drivers and self-driving cars, there will be accidents. So whether those accidents and unfortunate deaths that probably will happen will be enough for people to say, we don't want this, or, and get people afraid, is the question.
Self-driving ambulances, self-driving school buses.
Yeah. It's just amazing because the status quo is already quite intolerable. A lot of people die unnecessarily through cars. And I know people that have had car accidents and their whole lives were changed forever. But we don't think of, because it's the status quo, we don't think about it in that sense. We see that this is the norm. And then when somebody presents something where it's different, and instead of, you know, 1 in 20 accidents, you might have 1 in 100 accidents, we're so afraid of the change that we focus on the 1 in 100 and we're like, okay, you know. But it's understandable. These new things are going to take time. And
That's also confirmation bias. Like when I learned about confirmation bias, I felt so much more in control of reality. Because confirmation bias is this idea that once you believe something, so let's say self-driving cars are dangerous or deadly, you will always see information to validate that and then gloss over information that disproves it.
Yeah.
So for example, I might be like, oh man, like buses always come 2 at a time for me. So I always remember the examples when they do come 2 at a time. I never remember the times when they don't. So I think that's really interesting. I have a question for you though.
Go and shoot.
Would you go in an autonomous car? Like, would you
right
sit
now
in one? Let's say at the end of this year, Christmas. Come Christmas.
Yeah, I think I would.
Okay, what about Christmas 2019, autonomous airplane?
I think, but then aren't most airplanes autopiloted anyway?
Yeah, but I'm just saying no pilot in the cockpit at all. Would you go?
I think I might try it. Yeah, I think I would try it.
Yeah, because I
think so. But apparently, so no pilot to just in case, because right now
no pilot,
just empty cockpit.
Yeah, in fact, even the air hostesses are robots.
Oh Lord,
the drinks
mercy
are just dispensed from a machine.
Oh,
the food
man
comes out. We should do it
in 2019.
It's not that far away.
I'm talking that big talk now.
Where
I'll be like, I'll do it.
Where do you stop? Autonomous barber.
Oh, hell no. Trying to put my shape up. Hell no. not my shape up. Draw the line. Can you imagine going to the club with a effed up raggedy shape up and everyone's looking at you and you're like, yeah, you know what, the barber
autonomous,
he glitched, there was a glitch in the software. She went zoop and just messed it up. Nah,
someone could like hack the software and mess it up.
Yeah, that's another thing actually with self-driving cars, is that they can be hacked, as everything is connected to the internet. You know, you're gonna see probably a lot of political assassinations where all of a sudden the car went left because there's a guy at the back with a laptop just
watching the presidential procession, yeah, like, over the bridge.
We'll see the car go skrrr, freaking listen, I'm keeping it real. I think it was a news clip or some kind of BBC documentary where the guy was showing, he got the guy in a self-driving car. No, it wasn't even a self-driving car. It was just a normal modern day car. No, it was a normal modern day car, yeah, that's hooked up to the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
And the guy was able to take control from his laptop because he was a bad boy hacker. Yeah, yeah. So you can imagine when the car's completely self-driving, you know, car accidents. Saying. Yeah, you know, there's a glitch in the software. Watch all of a sudden. Back.
You got enemies.
This MP went missing. No, anyways. But yeah, let's keep an eye on this whole self-driving car thing. It's going to be interesting. You know what? I think we went through all of the madness.
We did.
Is there anything positive that we could talk about right at the end? Have you been reading anything good?
I'm reading Homo Deus.
How are you finding it?
It's really interesting. It's really, really good. I was surprised to learn that more people die from like sugar-related diseases than from violence itself.
Yeah, it's crazy. You are the most dangerous thing to yourself.
Yes.
Sugar is more dangerous than gunpowder, as he puts it.
Yeah.
It's crazy. But we don't think of it that way.
How many grams of sugar do you eat every day?
I don't track that kind of stuff.
You're supposed to have like at the maximum 30 grams, which is basically like
I think the thing is there's a lot of things that I eat that I don't even know how much sugar there is in there, but I know that there's like a whole bunch of sugar in there. And we don't think about it. It's a day-to-day type of stuff, you know. But Homo Deus is a great book. Have you read Sapiens? You should definitely read it.
I read Sapiens, yeah. That's what got me onto him.
Yeah.
So I loved Sapiens. Sapiens is where I found out that man and dog have been friends for 400,000 years or something crazy.
No, it's not 400. I think it's like
40,000.
Like, something like that, yeah.
It's still a long time. It's a hell of a long time. That's how dogs can read our faces.
Is it?
Like, yeah, dogs can read emotions, whereas cats are just like, whatever.
Nah, I mean, you know, back home in Africa, like, we don't like, in my country anyway, we don't like dogs. If I see a dog, I'm just like, no. It's quite a Western thing where everyone's like, oh, man's best friend, but no. I hate dogs.
Speak for yourself.
It's definitely both of those books I recommend. It's kind of weird, though, because it's such a tech bro book, because everybody says Sapiens is their favorite book. Like,
really?
I saw someone tweet, like, oh, every tech bro, love, like,
the hard thing about hard things.
That's one of it, but, like, in terms of, like, if you want to seem kind of intellectual.
Oh, right,
like,
yeah.
Sapiens, like. So I love Sapiens.
I didn't read
my girlfriend's
chapter.
Always getting on my back. Why not?
Because it's dense. Come on, like, hands up. If you bought the book, started the book, and didn't finish it, comment.
I've read it like 3-4 times. I read it like every year. I love the book so much.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Or you just didn't remember what happened in it.
No. That often does happen, though. I'll have to reread a book I'll read a book and be like, wait a minute, I've read this before.
Really?
Yeah. I've read this before. Yeah. But I do go through, I try to go through like quite a few books a year, so it can happen. But yeah, I saw him at a talk actually. He's really smart, and he's a big proponent of like meditation. He goes on these retreats for like a month, and no phone, no talking, no nothing. And then he came out and didn't know that Trump had won the election.
What a nightmare.
Could you do that? Like one of those kind of retreats where you don't
talk. You've met me now. Come on now. Me not talking for like a week.
Yeah, good point.
I could last maybe like a day and a half. But then I just start talking to myself. Like, what's up? I'm good. Yeah.
So
I want to though. No, seriously.
You've got
to
try it. Probably means
I'm writing my
most.
Second book. And I was like, actually, I want to go on one of those. Because I want to just be able to focus. I'm using Headspace. I do like meditation. I think it's really great. But yeah, I think I'd love to have the opportunity to be present in my own mind, on my own, without the influence of social media,
devices,
you, other people. I think that'd be great.
I'm a positive influence.
One thing I'll say about Homo Deus is, what do you think, rather, about his writing style and how he poses arguments and questions?
I think he's got quite a simple writing style. He poses quite complicated issues in quite, you know, a simplistic way. And he argues a lot through analogy, basically.
Well, that's the thing. He's very provocative. And like, ooh, well, what about this? What about that? I like it. It makes it like conversational for me.
That's quite provocative. What you're like.
It's just like often when you read books like that, it's almost like reading like an academic thesis or like an essay.
Mm.
So it's like, these are the facts and here's another fact and like blah, 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 blah. Whereas like he really builds the kind of like narrative into it. And present opposing thoughts together. So just like the way he says, more people die by consuming sugar than by violence today. Yeah. And this idea of like suppressing our natural impulses through drugs and whatever.
Mm.
One thing that did make me sad in Homo Deus actually was finding out that the only reason sex is pleasurable is because if it wasn't, then we wouldn't do it. And then we wouldn't further our seed and survive.
Yeah.
I'm a romantic. And also, it's not always pleasurable. So, I mean, like, yeah, clearly true. There's a flaw in evolution there.
I've heard that from women. A lot of other women. not my own personal case. Not my own personal. I mean, in general. Anyway, he's an amazing writer. I mean, I heard someone describe Sapiens as like, when you're a human being and you read that book, it's like being in a terrain that you've been around for a long time and then climbing up to a mountain and seeing like the whole picture.
Ooh, I like that.
Just the way he kind of explains things, like something as simple as money, for example. We all use it and take it for granted, but essentially, the way he describes it, it's just a story.
Yes.
We imbue it with this value. It's just a piece of paper. You can never go to, you know, a monkey and say, here's this piece of paper, give me a banana.
Oh, like value.
Yeah. It literally doesn't mean anything. It's just a piece of paper.
But same thing with Bitcoin, Ethereum.
Bitcoin, crypto, absolutely. Yeah, but all of it is stories. All of it is a story. A corporation is a story.
Facebook is a story. Yeah. You're a story. I'm a story.
No, well, me and you do have a biological, you know, reality.
But you're not Michael.
You're right. Michael
is. You can't cut me and see Abadesi.
Yeah, absolutely right. You're right. Software engineer, that's a story. My title as what, if I would call myself that. Everything, yeah, it's just really eye-opening.
One thing that made me sad in that money chapter in Sapiens was when he says that the oldest record... Okay, if I said to you, I have found the oldest piece of like recorded writing by a human being.
Mm.
What might you think that is? You might think,
like a poetry, love story?
Right, yeah. Yeah. To think it's something nice. It was literally like a record of how many bushels of corn had been taken and how much money they were worth.
It makes sense.
It was a ledger.
That's how it would start. We need to record. Who's got my paper? You owe me this. Like, I'm writing this down.
Receipts.
Yeah, yeah. I think we should put like an Amazon link at the bottom because we've been plugging this book for the last 10 minutes.
So
we need to get some coin.
Anyway, yeah, cool. So let's wrap it up.
All right.
Episode 5.
Episode 5. Thank you very much for listening and sticking with us.
Please continue to follow us on SoundCloud, share your comments, like us. We're on Overcast now, thanks to Michael. Yeah. So Android users, get on that.
Mm.
Apple
Podcasts.
We're
on Google Play too as well. You should be able to find us on Google Play, which is there.
Apple Podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, please let us know. # techish on social media. Maybe forward it on to a friend who might like to listen to it. If you have ideas for how we can make the show better, you know where to find us. Let us know. What more do you want to hear? What topics do you want to hear about? Are there any stories that we should cover? I really liked that, like, this week people were like flagging stuff.
Yeah, they were like,
oh my god,
talk about this.
This episode's gonna be busy. And you know what, you were right, it was. But episode 6 will be even better with your help.